This is our last full day of retreat, I'll be saying a few things about daily life practice. I was going to start with talking about the way we experience everything through our senses, and everything we experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. And there's no attachment to the things we experience. The experiences easily come and go, and there's no stress. But if we get attached to that pleasant or unpleasant, or don't happen to notice what it is we're not noticing, we can get in trouble sometimes. And when those things happen, then there's dukkha, there's attachment, there's suffering. In Buddhist psychology, there is sometimes referred to these three personality types. I know many of you have heard this, so I'm not going to go into this in any deep psychological way. It's based on which of these three ways of perceiving tends to be more habitual for you. For instance, some people, you know, they tend to always be focused on, oh, I want this. I want to go on this trip and that trip and this and this. And others of us are, what's wrong with them? And being critical of others all the time. And something's wrong with the food. And so some of us are definitely much more what we call the aversion type as opposed to the desire type. And then the ones who don't notice a lot of things, neither pleasant or unpleasant, tend to be the delusion types. So it's way over simplified, okay? but it makes the point. Now, there's a metaphor, and my own version of it is there's a party at a wealthy friend's home, and the desire type walks into the house, and they see this beautiful, beautiful view. God, it's an amazing view. But very soon, they're no longer enjoying the view, but thinking, oh, I want a house just like this with a view like this, and I need to get a better job, and they're lost in desire. They're caught in desire, no longer experiencing the simple pleasure of this beautiful view. Now, the aversion type, you know, there's this beautiful house and a beautiful view, but what they notice is the stain on the rug, little small stain in the corner. Yeah, and then they go to this amazing buffet and they just see, oh, all desserts are junk food. It's the wrong music, and don't even get them started on the guests. Yeah. Now, the delusion type, they don't notice any of it, including the fact that everyone else took their shoes off at the door except for them. So, as I said, it's oversimplified, but it really points to the habits that we have. None of them are better than the other. Sometimes people go, oh, I'd rather be a desire type than an aversion type. But really, I think that they're all cause an equal amount of dukkha. Unless we're on retreat, we spend most of our waking hours not in meditation. And the habits, you know, maybe we spend every day, you know, we have a strong daily practice, and we spend, you know, an hour, and we're developing this really wonderful, wholesome habit of showing up. But if the rest of our days most of the rest of the time in our habits of aversion and desire and getting caught in those and sloth and torpor and restlessness and doubt, we're strengthening those habits in ourselves. And even though there's this wonderful residual that comes from the meditation. Even if we do nothing else, meditation like has a residual. It has an effect in our lives. But still, those habits in our lives can be so strong, just so strong. The process in which when we do something once, we haven't developed a habit, right? But if you, like playing the piano, I remember when I was learning to play the piano and, you know, I kind of wanted to find out what the song sounded like. And so I would kind of hurry up through the difficult part and I'd make a mistake, but keep going because I really wanted to find out how it ended, you know. And I would just develop this mistake. And sure enough, when I played it again, same mistake. And I kept doing it, and that there was the same mistake. It was facilitation. It's like my body learned that habit. And this is a little bit how our unuseful habits work. That we're just used to them. They're just habitual. And they show up when we least want them to show up, usually. So cultivating mindfulness in daily life weakens these habits of mind and strengthens the ones that support our freedom. Some level of confidence is needed to apply ourselves in meditation. If not, none of you would be here. Everyone here, no matter how lousy meditator you think you might be, you have some level of confidence or you wouldn't have lasted the week. But one thing to realize is that having confidence in the path, in this path of practice, is not different than having confidence in yourself. The path is really only about that we have the ability to be free. So if we're confident in the path, we're confident in the fact that we can be free. And we've all at least started the path. As our practice deepens, we can become more and more at ease. And the phrase that sometimes I've used is we can be comfortable in our own skin. Just what it is to just be fully okay, just how we are. Just how we are, warts and all. You know, just how we are. You know, not because we look good, not because we've accomplished something, you know, on the long list of why I'm worthwhile, or because we have good social skills, but because we trust our own goodness, our own goodness of heart. And we can trust our innate goodness even if we get angry, even if we get confused, especially if we make mistakes. But trust is trusting the path that includes all our imperfections. So when I was a teenager, I had a friend whose parents, you know, were called at the time, we said they were really cool. You know, they let us do anything and everything, and they were and we could have parties anytime we wanted in their house, and even with them in the house, they'd just go off in their own space and leave us alone. And so, you know, we had these what looked, you know, like really great parties, and I was always uncomfortable in social situations. I was really self-conscious. And but I pretended I wasn't, and as teenagers tend to do. So my solution was to find someone to talk to, and then we'd go off on our own and have a conversation. I did feel comfortable with people one-on-one, and we'd often go into the closet. You know, that gave us a nice little space to have a private conversation. So Now, the clock goes forward many years. And at the end of my first three-month retreat, I wasn't trying to change anything. I came home, and just something in me had shifted. And to my surprise, I was being asked, a lot of by Gil, to do things that I was really uncomfortable with, things that really stretched me. And I found myself, you know, feeling the fear, feeling the discomfort, and saying, yes. And, you know, it reminds me of a little bit of, I think what brought that to mind was Marjolaine's reflection last night, you know, about saying yes. And so all things showed up in my life all of a sudden, all sorts of different things that were challenging. And it was like I never considered saying no. It was such a deep movement in me to say yes, to be at that edge of my life. And I felt insecure many times. You know, I did all sorts of things. I remember being asked to teach the teen program. Gil was at an airport, and he said, my flight's delayed. Can you teach it for me? And at the school I went to, teenagers, you did not want to be the teacher to a teenage class. So those were the associations I had, you know, and I felt really pretty clueless, you know, and but I thought, okay, yes, of course, you know, I don't think I expressed any of that to Gil, and I showed up, and I was so surprised. These kids were really cool. I mean, they were really amazing. They had so much depth, so much care, so much sincerity. And I had a great time. We had a really good class, you know. And so I was so glad I did it. You know, but even though I was doing this, you know, one of the things I was very aware of is that social fear I had in groups hadn't changed at all. As soon as I, you know, we had the Sangha at IMC at that time, it was growing, you know, and after the Sunday morning talk, there'd be all these people meandering about, you know, maybe 75 people would stay, and they're all meandering about talking, just kind of like a cocktail party without drinks, you know. and I just, you know, it was like what I hated the most in life. And so I looked around and I saw someone who looked a lot more uncomfortable than me. And I went up to them, you know, and I welcomed them and tried to make them feel comfortable. And I felt great. And so I started doing that every Sunday morning. I'd go find somebody who was either standing alone or someone who just looked a little bit uncomfortable or, you know, or lonely, or, and I'd welcome them. Eventually, you know, each time, you know, I just felt better and better and better. And at one point, I realized I was no longer doing it for me. You know, that I didn't need to, you know, I didn't need to feel better. I was, you know, really seeing them and just loving them, wanting them to feel good. And, you know, it was a practice that that was not easy. You know, it really, for me, it took courage. I know some people jump out of airplanes, but for me, that was jumping out of an airplane. There's a phrase that I really have come to appreciate. I think I heard it first from Gregory Kramer. The phrase is called social dukkha. And it's referring to all the social awkwardness and discomfort that we have. You know, people have it in many different ways. You know, some people love parties. You know, some people, but boy, one-on-one, or talking about something personal, or going to practice discussion, You know, all these things, we all have the different aspects of not being comfortable in our own skin. And therefore, we may not be comfortable with other people in certain ways. And we're protected. And the thing that I appreciate about that phrase is that, of course, there's social dukkha. It's just dukkha. It's not a special shame that I have. It's nothing special about it. It's just no different than the dukkha we have because it's too hot or too cold or anything else that, you know, or craving minds want to complain about. Now, when given a choice, most people tend to opt for being comfortable. Now, what's comfortable for one person is not comfortable for another. As I mentioned, you know, I knew someone who liked to, you know, jump out of planes, go hang gliding, do all these things that looked pretty scary to me, and yet he couldn't go to a restaurant and sit by himself. You know, that was just really traumatic for him to just sit alone, you know, without anybody there and have a meal. So courage it just takes all sorts of different forms in all of us. One way to think about this is that imagine we live in a perfect room with a perfect view, with, you know, it's really quiet, the temperature's just right, everything's just the way we want it. And the more we live there, the harder it is to leave that room, the more stressful it is, the more stressful it is. And coming on retreat, many of us were required to leave a bit of our comfort zone. I know some people, there's some people here, this was their first retreat. And I know for them, you know, like Gil mentioned, you know, he had to cancel his retreat for a very urgent reason. You know, he was scared. And, you know, so leaving our comfort zone, when we go to the edge of our comfort zone, that's where we grow. And a way to think about it is, you know, if you've done yoga or lifted weights or, you know, any physical activity, you find that there's an edge that we go to. And like when you stretch, you know, you don't stretch enough, nothing happens. But you go right to that edge where it's just a tiny bit uncomfortable, you know, and you can play with that. And that's how you get more flexible. You go beyond that edge very quickly and you hurt yourself, you know, so we play on that edge. And the same thing we can do with bringing courage into our lives, playing the edges of our discomfort. And, you know, not doing it so harshly that we hurt ourselves, not, okay, I'm going to rip myself open, you know, I'm going to get there. You know, but really just really kindly, gently go to that edge and respect it, respect the edge. In our daily lives, there can be an endless number of opportunities to let go of attachments. You know, someone, and sorry for quoting you, if you mind my quoting you, but I won't say your name, but somebody said, you know, they got caught by a hindrance, by a multiple hindrance attack yesterday, and they missed it, you know, and they lost an opportunity. And, you know, my response was, you'll get plenty of opportunities. We can look in a lot of places in our lives and have lots of opportunities. And I want to mention one in particular because it's something that something that can be useful. It's been useful for a lot of people. And it's the pile of paper story. And one of my students that I was mentoring, you know, his life was, he had a very strong practice. Most things in his life were working really well, but he had this desk. And this desk had piles, you know, piles of papers. You know, he had all this correspondence, all this mail, all these things. And every time he walked by it, his stomach would tighten. It was just stressful. And, you know, he'd eventually force himself to do a little bit of it. And then, you know, new ones would show up. So there's always this pile, this endless pile. And so what I recommended to him was that he treat the pile as his formal daily practice. And that every time he walked by the pile, he would bow to it and practice with one piece of paper, just one article, and pay attention to what hindrance showed up. And over time, and just one, and then he'd walk away. You know, he could do it again next time he came by. And over time, he mentioned every single one of the five hindrances. You know, what if I need it someday? You know, fear of the future. You know, oh, I'm going to go to that concert. Oh, I'm going to want to go to that concert. I'm going to save it. You know, so desire. You know, taxes. Oh, lethargy. That could, or maybe multiple hindrances, right? Aversion goes really well with that. But it was a really, really wonderful practice. As he kept doing this, he started picking up two papers and three papers. And then, you know, eventually something really eased in him. And he was able to meet it one thing at a time, just one paper at a time. And it was no longer a problem. But he deconditioned himself. You know, he very gradually deconditioned himself by bringing in wholesome actions into an unwholesome, compulsive habit of turning away from the difficult. I'll mention another story. This isn't, I'm not sure this is a, if this is a real story or not, or a made-up one, but it serves the point. It's about a monk who meditated for years in a cave up in a mountain, and he spent much of his time in blissful silence. But one year, due to circumstances, he had to go down the mountain and into town. And as he was walking down the path, a traveler was coming up, you know, and the traveler coming up was carrying stuff, and he accidentally just jostled him. And the monk found this huge anger coursing through his body of being jostled and hit the guy. You know, just out of nowhere, conditioned. But all his years in the cave, nothing had pushed that in him. Nothing had brought that up. And there's nothing like other people to let us know how we're attached. And for many of us, the people closest to us are the ones who teach us the most about our own attachments. And the way my husband put it is, no wonder our parents can push our buttons so easily. They installed them. So I'd like to share some of the daily practices that have been particularly helpful for me in my life. We try to have the... sorry. I'm identifying with someone here. I'm just going to tell you something totally off the wall. When I was teaching a course once, you know, to about 40 people, and not a Dharma course, it was a preparatory course for tests, And one of my friends was sitting in the front row, just about 3 feet in front of me. And as I was speaking, I accidentally spit. And she looked up and followed the spit with her eyes, rolling her eyes. And I had to leave the room because every time I tried to talk, I just started laughing. So it's very contagious. So back to daily life practices. You know, at first when we practice being mindful, it feels awkward. It feels like we're doing something, we're working at it. And then as it becomes more and more part of our lives, it just begins to be more natural. And so what we're do with these daily life practices is we're just developing them, creating the habit. So just like a piece of music that we know well, it just becomes more of a flow. Oh, this is fun to play this. I love this song. And so we're shaping our habitual minds to, instead of being distracted all the time, to being here all the time. And that shift in our minds does take a certain level of effort over and over again. It can be a lot simpler to be mindful when we're alone. Just like it's a lot simpler to do, to have noble silence when we're alone. And the practice gets more complicated when we're doing, when we're talking to people, or we're on the computer, or we're reading a book, or even watching a movie. So being mindful, the skill level needed to be mindful in the more complex situations is a little bit higher. So in developing this practice in daily life, it really helps to start with what's simple. And the very first thing that I started with, you know, and that I really liked was brushing my teeth. And, you know, I was taught to brush my teeth mindfully, one quarter at a time. So it took 2 minutes, you know, 30 seconds each quarter. And really feel the bristle, you know, at the gum line where you're supposed to brush, you know, we're supposed to clean it. And connect that way. And, you know, actually what I didn't realize at the time of doing it, you know, I was thinking this is mindfulness practice. But if you actually stay mindful for every single one of those 32 teeth, that probably is longer than how many breaths you paid attention to sometimes, right? And it develops concentration. And so I took to doing that, twice a day I would do that. And I found it a really good start to my mindfulness practice in daily life, but I also found a really good help in concentration. So developing a daily practice, I know some of you have mentioned you're struggling with that. You know, a lot of people come and retreat, and we've got the support of each other, you know, and that goes a long way. You know, you walk into this meditation hall, and, you know, there's just something that really helps you sit here and be still and quiet. And that's why sometimes it's really helpful to practice with others. You know, I had a couple of people who were in one of my courses. You know, they lived in different states. It was an online course some years back. And they were really good friends, you know, and they would call each other every day and say, okay, I'm going to go sit. Okay, I'm going to go sit too. Have a good sit and hang up, you know, and just that. That was enough for them both to develop a really regular practice. I don't know how long they did it for, but I know during the period I stayed in touch, which was, you know, maybe several months, they, you know, they practiced every day. So, You know, it's funny because here in the Bay Area, we've had sitting groups, you know, an embarrassment of how many sitting groups we have. It's been such a rich area. You know, with COVID, you know, we haven't been able to sit in the same room. But to our surprise, the online sangha has just flourished. And it's been such a gift, such a gift. And I know my guess is that quite a few of you sit with Gil on weekdays, right? Yes, a lot of you, a lot of you, yep. And, you know, and that helps, right? That gives us the support. And so if you need support, you know, see if you can find a friend to do it with, or some way of sitting with the group a couple of times a week, or an online sangha, or however you can find that support. One of the things that can be really helpful in daily life is to find a way to regularly check in with your body, even if it's a very brief period. And what I really liked using is what I call bro. It's like a brother that's always with us. And it stands for breathe, relax, and open. You know, just one breath is often enough to really show up and relax everything, relax the body, and then open to what's happening in our lives, what's happening right here, right now. And for me, making that a habit throughout the day, you know, where just no matter what I was doing, every once in a while, I would just, you know, take a deep breath and just arrive. So if that's helpful, you know, I'll mention a few things, you know, and maybe something resonates, you know. What resonates for one person may not resonate for another. Someone I know, they use the belly, keeping a soft belly, because they found that they were always contracted, you know, and so that became a reinforcement for staying relaxed. And in this culture, a lot of people have been taught that it's wrong to have a relaxed belly, you know, that this idea that we're supposed to have this kind of military posture. Somewhere, I think, in the 40s, you know, somebody wrote this exercise book of military exercises, and at least that's the first time, that's where I saw the earliest instance of this. And they said, yeah, contract the belly, you know, and stay really straight, you know, and even though we want to have strong abdominal muscles, and we want to contract them if we're doing some heavy lifting. The rest of the time, it's not natural to have our muscles contracted for no reason at all. And so I really recommend, you know, keeping the belly relaxed, keeping the whole body relaxed. Only tensing what we need to tense to use. Practices like yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, all those practices can complement mindfulness. You know, if we don't do them like a workshop or like we're trying to get somewhere. But probably the one practice that for me was particularly instrumental in weaving mindfulness in my life. You know, I'd been doing this for a number of years, but it was again at the end of a retreat. For some reason, these things always come up at the end of retreats for me. And I was sitting at my desk, and I was been working for a few hours without moving. You know, I was really into my project, and I had to pee. Yeah. And I didn't want to go. I didn't want to rip myself away from what I was doing. You know, it's just like, no, I want to keep going. You know, and but after a while, you know, you just have to go, right? And so I went and came back, and as I was coming back, I realized I was really uptight, and this was like 2 days after the retreat, you know, and it became so obvious to me what I was doing. So I made a commitment to myself that not only would I get up every hour at least, or close, you know, not in a regimented way, but in an easy way, but that I would do walking meditation to my next activity. Not slowly, not slowly. You know, it might be, you know, fairly fast, you know, which is like might be only 15 steps. To get a glass of water, to go to the restroom, to you know, get into the car, or to get out of the car. I'm still sitting out of from any time I get up from sitting, so I'm in the car, and I get up and do mindful meditation to the store, and that practice immediately put me in my body, immediately got me in touch with the present, and immediately disengaged me from the work I was doing. And what I noticed was how attached my mind was, how much it didn't want to let that go. No, I want to think about that. I really want to think about that. You know, and I really examined what I was attached to see, is it really, am I really going to lose the whole thread if I disengage? And the truth was, I'd come back fresher, and it didn't affect it in any negative way, you know, in any negative way. And so I really recommend that. Another great opportunity to develop mindfulness for those of you who have no extra time in your lives is mindfulness of waiting. Because we all have opportunities to wait. We're waiting on the phone. Now that people are driving more, you know, waiting in gridlock, at least in the Bay Area, we are. You know, and so when we find ourselves in these situations, at the doctor's office, waiting in line, great, more time to meditate. You know, so really, you know, it's a really, you know, why be miserable? When we have a choice, we have a choice. I get excited about these things because they had such an impact on me. So the next one that had an impact, and this was a different retreat after a different retreat, was at this time I was the work I was doing was generating at least 100 emails every day. And I had been on a week-long retreat, and my email box was daunting. It was daunting. And I sat down with my first email, and my mind just got dark, you know. And you know, but I was still very, very mindful of my process. And so I thought about it. I thought, okay, what am I doing? And it was an email from someone I didn't know. And I took a moment and I wondered about the person, you know, and I thought, you know, I just connected with them in a certain impersonal way, you know, and wished them well, you know, and smiled and just kind of spontaneously happened. And I started doing that as a practice. And that with every email, not taking a long time, but just for a moment, connecting who I was emailing. Whether it was just a quick, yep, you know, or it didn't matter. It was just a very quick moment of connection in my heart and a smile. And it made me happy. So it was a very, it's been a kind of a habit for many years. And then the last thing, I'll share a story that is, it's not my story, but a Dharma teacher who went on retreat, it was a three-month retreat at the time, and, you know, it was hard to go because her husband really didn't want her to go. So when she came back, she really wanted to impress him, you know, look how enlightened I am, you know. And I think it was before she was teaching. But, and so, you know, she came home and, you know, within 4 hours, she was screaming at him at the top of her lungs. So the defilements, you know, show up when they show up, you know. And the reason I tell that, you know, as I'm wrapping up this talk, is that, you know, we include it all in this practice, all our imperfections, all the defilements that show up when they show up. You know, there's times of purity, times of purification, and these things, you know, these are our habits. It's really important not to add unskillful judgment to our suffering. It's much more helpful to say, this is dukkha, this is suffering. And to bring compassion to ourselves at those times. And of course, to apologize. But so I want to end with something the Buddha said. You can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. So thank you. Let's sit for a minute, share the silence together.